Guru Nation, welcome to episode 802 of Random Musings from the Galenical Trials Guru. In this episode, we talked to a private equity firm, actually a vice president there, about why there's so much interest in clinical research sites right now. Why they're being acquired, what's the process like for a site that's maybe exploring ways to get acquired. If you're a site and want to position yourself, you need to listen. If you're a sponsor or CRO and you want to know what's going on, check it out. Link to Leyland's LinkedIn is underneath this podcast episode. So go click and connect with him. He's obviously a very knowledgeable person. Thank you very much to Leyland for coming on. Not many people in his position do so. Really quick shout out to the sponsor, Innato. Innato is a free website where you can go get studies for your site. Yes, you do need therapeutic area expertise, but it is absolutely free. They do not get involved in any other aspect of your study, no contract and budget management. Anything. They're literally just setting up sponsors with appropriate sites. They get all their funding from sponsors. Very site-centric. Check it out. I'm a huge fan and a proud to have them as a supporter of this podcast. Also, shout out to Creo. They do eSource, eReg, CTMS, patient database, auto texting. You only pay for what you use. I cannot live life at my site without Creo. So go check it out in the show notes as well. And with that being said, enjoy the show. Guru Nation, we got a classic. Thanks to Chris and thanks to Leland. We got Leland Garahan. He's part of a small, maybe boutique healthcare investment firm. And we're gonna get right into it. But Leland's first gonna talk about his background. But this is important because right now there's a lot of acquisitions, a lot of consolidation, a lot of sites that are entertaining offers that never in their wildest dreams would have had offers. And myself, I'm a site owner. Chris is a site owner. So Leland's gonna actually ask us like some questions that he would ask a real site in the wild when they're looking to acquire. So, Leland, thank you for coming on, man, and maybe give us some background as to who you are and your firm. And his LinkedIn and the website for his firm is underneath this video, or if you're listening in the show notes for posterity's sake, go click, give it a click and learn something.
Sure. Thank you, Dan and Chris. It's great to be here. As you mentioned, I work for a small healthcare-focused investor, MedEquity Capital. We're based out of Boston and have been investing exclusively in healthcare businesses since the late 90s. Historically, it's been a lot of multi-site provider businesses and those that are involved in pharmacy or distribution. But over the course of that 25 or so years, it's spanned anything in healthcare services as long as it doesn't have FDA approval risk. So we're not investing in products, life science products. And the way we think about investing is that we are a very hands-on investor when we need to be. We're very comfortable being involved in, almost up to the day-to-day, not quite day-to-day with the business owners that we partner with, and up to and even including jumping into interim positions in leadership, finance, business development as needed. But we recognize that we're not the experts in the space. It's the business owners and leaders that we partner with. And so we're not writing the strategy. It's up to the experts to do that. We're there to act as a sounding board to provide capital to make some of the improvements that can help the business grow and improve performance, to introduce them to potential hires, to new customers, and in general, provide some of the wisdom that we've seen over those 25 years working with companies. I myself have not been involved in doing so for 25 years. I'm the junior guy on the team. But have been involved in healthcare since undergrad, pre-med bio major, worked with the Centers for Medicare/Medicaid Services for a while, some life science consulting, business school with a healthcare focus, and now with MedEquity. And as you guys and your listeners well know, a lot of interest from investors in your world over the past several years, and I think there's good reason to think that's going to continue going forward. And so it's a great opportunity to be here and talk about it candidly. You know, maybe your listeners can learn a little bit about how investors think about the space, and of course I can learn a little bit more from you guys who have, you know, are doing this day in and day out and have a lot of connections and conversations with people that are doing similar things.
Yeah, let's get into it. So the market is has an appetite for consolidation, especially at the site level. I mean, we've already received several offers, and our company's not even 3 years old here in Yuma, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I know colleagues of mine, they have like 5 year old companies already getting letters of intent. I don't know if I want to say the multiple, but let's say it's a healthy multiple, maybe 5 to 10x EBITDA. What do you think is driving all of this? And then what's your role in this whole kind of situation or dynamic?
Sure. So I think I can't speak for every investor, but the way that we think about it is from a macro perspective, what are some of the big trends in healthcare, and what does that mean for more specific subsectors or niches within the space? And I probably won't be telling you guys anything new, but you know, the way we think about sites is backing up. If you look at R&D spend overall, it's been growing year over year with some hiccups for a long, long time. There's a law called Eram's law, which is the inverse of Moore's law from the computing world. Moore's law said that every 2 years, the number of transistors in an integrated circuit would double. Eram's law is a story of declining efficiency. You know, every 9 years or so, the number of drugs per dollar spent approved halves. So you basically need twice as much money to get one drug approved.
Is that true?
It's
a lot. It's a lot, Chris.
The original article was written in 2012, and I haven't done the math since then, but the general trend is still true. Maybe it's not every 9 years, but it's something to that effect.
I haven't heard that either, so that's thank you for sharing that with me. Maybe just as surprised as Chris, but maybe that makes sense why so many biotechs keep popping up and why most of the innovation, because I've read similar articles, the majority of the innovation and the research in life sciences come from biotechs. They don't come from the big pharma. The big pharma have just become acquirers of IP. They don't really innovate anymore, and they let their capital work for them. But it's interesting to see how this actually affects the sites, which normally the sites are kind of indifferent to who innovates. We don't care. We just do studies. But it's starting to, from what I understand, trickle down to us, because how do you think this law applies to sites' activities?
So I think that it indirectly applies to sites. It means that for the sponsors and to a lesser degree the CROs, the value of their time in dollar terms is getting higher and higher, and delays are more and more costly. And so anything that they can do to expedite a clinical trial or ensure it's got a higher chance of succeeding becomes increasingly worth it. And as we all know, one of the big bottlenecks, perhaps the big bottleneck, is in finding patients for those later trials and completing the protocol with those patients. And as much as the CROs and sites, you know, can help with that, and they definitely can, it's the point of contact with the patients at the site level that maybe has the most leverage when it comes to improving that process. And so that increases the bargaining power of the sites a little bit. It makes the sites more important. And you mentioned this, Dan, and I think probably a lot of your listeners would agree, it doesn't feel that way all the time when you're interacting with the the sponsors and the CROs, but you know, we think that it's trending a little bit in that direction, and increasingly so. And then you know, so an investor might think, okay, there's more bargaining power for sites, there's more dollars going into the space. Another trend I didn't mention is the type of trials that are going on that are becoming a little bit more complicated, with, you know, more endpoints, more inclusion, exclusion criteria, et cetera. And so if you're able to take a few sites, or in the case of a, you know, Velocity or whoever, a lot of sites, and aggregate all of that demand, or all of that ability to recruit and conduct a clinical trial with a lot of patients, you're able to magnify that bargaining power with the sponsors and CROs that much more. And you know, I think that's the thinking behind a lot of investors in the space. There's a little bit of fear of missing out, you know, probably going on. These things tend to happen in waves. You know, one or two investors do something and others follow. There's also the whole, you know, the COVID-19 vaccine kind of boom in demand. So a few other nuances happening, but that's, I think, the basic thesis, as at least as we see it.
Chris, I know you're chomping at the bits here.
No, not so much, but I know we were having a conversation, Leland, a few days ago, and you were seeking some information. So you want to pick that up where we left off? I mean, maybe we can start there, answering some of your questions.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer on behalf of Yuma Clinical Trials. And if I don't feel comfortable answering it for YCT specifically, Chris and I will try to answer in general. But I think I'm pretty comfortable.
Okay, great. Well, you know, before I ask you that, I think just to let you know how we would think about it, the most important thing is understanding the business owners and leaders and their story, their goals, you know, with the business and you know, broader, and what motivates them. And I think that is the number one factor that dictates how we would interact with a company and the questions we would ask them. But moving past that, I think one of the biggest decision points for an investor is, what's the basic business model of a SMO or site network that makes the most sense? And there's a few ways to think about it. One way is kind of on this embedded model versus dedicated site spectrum. And another one would be, do you specialize in a certain therapeutic area type of trial, or do you go broad? You know, we think both, you know, there's lots of different ways to succeed here, but I think it'd be helpful to hear from you guys, you know, about what the trade-offs are between those different business models, and if you're comfortable sharing for Yuma, you know, why you ended up pursuing the model that you did.
Yeah. Okay. So we use a hub and spoke model. So initially, to keep costs low when we started out, we partnered with one internal medicine doctor who had a private practice, and we were embedded in his practice. The issue with that, probably a year into it, was we ran out of space. We still occupy some space in his office. We get access to clinic rooms, exam rooms whenever we need them. We even have our own space there for our staff. It's like a conference room that no one else uses except us. So we do have like some workspace there. But we've employed the hub and spoke model because we, soon after the internal medicine doctor, we got a dermatologist at a separate location. He had no space other than exam rooms for us to use and some minimal space to store drug. So we quickly realized, hey, we're going to need our own space. So we got our own space. We probably have 1,000 square feet, maybe a little more, outside, like in a central hub where there are no private practice. It's standalone. So we can also see patients there, store drugs there, meet monitors there. It's on the 1572 for all the studies. And then we now have a psychiatrist with another office. Same situation as the derm. No space in his office. With the psychiatrist, not even exam rooms. So we do all the psych visits at our main hub. We just landed a pulmonologist who I'm texting now. I think we might get our first site selection visit soon. And we have a cardiologist who I haven't been able to get a study for yet. And they all have their own offices. And the last two, the pulmonologist and the cardiologist, do have space in their office. So we could do more actual work there while not having to spend more money to expand our hub. And that's our model. The pros are you don't need to spend money up front, which is critical. Like, we didn't really spend anything on rent until we could afford it. The cons are a little bit of out of sight, out of mind. So with our first PI, the internal medicine, we made him a partner of the main hub. So he's an equity partner. And he's actually the one who introduced us to the other specialists. We still go to the office just to get referrals from the providers. He has like 10 providers there. And then we try to do the same thing with all the specialists, because we realized even with all the tech we have, we're trying to implement AI and the EMRs and all that stuff, which is not working quite yet. There's no substitute for getting a referral from that PI, like old-fashioned way. Hey, Dan, here, I saw a patient today. Can someone pre-screen him? It's a lot easier if someone's in the office there at the clinic, right? Rather than having the patient come to our hub, which is only 5 minutes away. I mean, Yuma's everything we got like in 1 5-mile radius. So it's not a lot of driving for anyone. That's the con. The con is you're kind of fragmented in different places. You have some IP at this address, other IP at this location, some lab kits here, some lab kits there. To me, I think the pros outweigh the cons. It's worked well for us, and we'll continue to grow under the hub and spoke model. It just makes the most sense for us.
And wouldn't you say, Dan, if you were in Leland's shoes and you're acquiring not necessarily a network of sites, well, in this case it would be, but wouldn't you primarily focus on multi-specialty groups?
Yep. Therapeutic area droughts are real. Like, we see GI busy right now. We see OBGYN very dry. We see psych busy. We see cardio a little bit dry. We see derm couple years ago really busy, now it's just moderately busy. So it's nice to have some diversity within your service offerings.
Yep,
absolutely. And I think that means that there's kind of a floor in terms of the size of the company that would be suitable for an investor. Because, you know, compared to a venture capitalist, somebody on the private equity side has more emphasis on the downside risk. What could go wrong? Because we can't afford to bet on a bunch of companies and have some of them succeed and some of them not. Our investors in our fund are counting on every single investment being a success. And so if you're a smaller site or a smaller site network, or you only have one therapeutic area that you focus on and one of these droughts hits you and the trials kind of dry up, that's a problem.
We see that every day. Well, not every day, but regularly as with our clients, because Chris and I have a site network where we help sites, 80 some sites across the country, get studies, do their biz dev. And Chris, I think, is regularly lately talking to people that specialized too much and didn't focus on diversifying their service offerings, which generally not a good idea if you want to build a sustainable business, in my opinion.
It can be problematic for sure.
Right. Right. And, you know, another one of the challenges, certainly for you guys and folks that are running sites, but also for investors, as we think about how do we mitigate the risk that an investment doesn't work out, is thinking about the pipeline and the studies that are coming through it and how we can estimate the revenue from those. And it's a bit of an intractable problem. You only have so much visibility and there's delays all the time. You know, I'm sure you guys could, you know, talk about stories about things getting canceled or postponed at the last second, and struggles recruiting patients, et cetera. So that revenue visibility is, and the timing of when it's going to hit is definitely going to be a focal point for a lot of investors when they think about the space. So I'd love to hear from you guys, maybe either how you manage it at Yuma or when you're talking to clients, how you think about seeing out, you know, as far as you can into the future from a revenue perspective.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say my general rule is, as a business, you should keep at least 3, if not 6 months expenses aside. That way you can buffer against these occurrences. However, even 6 months is potentially not enough, though generally speaking, it should be.
Yeah, I agree. I think we definitely do that. As we've been growing, we have been increasing our expenses, not drastically. We're still running a roughly 70% profit margin. The PI's compensation is not included in that. They are usually equity partners in either the main LLC, as in the case of the main PI, the internal medicine, or we have smaller LLCs that Yuma Clinical Trials owns a majority share of, and then the specialist owns a minority share of that particular specialty LLC. So, for example, Yuma Clinical Trials will own 75% of Yuma CNS research, and the other 25% is owned by the psychiatrist. So that's, our profit margins are high. We don't pay our PIs unless we're profitable, which is, I don't know if it's attractive or not for private equity, but it's worked for us. It allows us to have a buffer at all times.
Right. Pros and cons, as you said. The pro there is that if revenue dries up, you're less on the hook to pay your investigators. And you know, if you want to grow, you don't need to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in new square footage to set up your own sites. So maybe in that light, another typical question would be how the business owner thinks about the path forward and growing the business. You're navigating between some uncertainty about what's coming down the pipeline, making sure you have these backup emergency expenses, as you mentioned, Chris, thinking about personnel that you might have to add to the team, other, you know, technology solutions or more back office functions that need to be improved. So, you know, how do you think you guys or others in your space think about moving from, you know, maybe a site that's doing, you know, a couple million in EBITDA to larger or whichever threshold that, you know, you guys feel comfortable talking about?
Well, in a town like Yuma, which is 100,000 people, in the winter it's doubles, and there's no competition. The closest competition is Phoenix or San Diego, which are about 3 hours driving each in different directions. There is a large hospital in town that is private equity backed and owns, I would say, 75% of the healthcare providers in the town. So certain specialties, and they won't let them work with us. So certain specialties we already can't do. Like, we can't do OBGYN or gastroenterology. Every single OBGYN is owned by the hospital. And every get there is an independent gastroenterology doctor that just sold his practice to the hospital. So he'd be willing to work with us when his non-compete expires, which he already told us that. But the issue is the colonoscopy. Most of these GI units require a colonoscopy. The only colonoscopy center is owned by the hospital. So our growth is limited in some respects. There are still other specialties we can get to, like oncology is one. There is an independent oncology group that I've been trying to get a hold. I'm literally texting one of our PIs now to give me a referral to this owner of the oncology practice that lives in Phoenix, doesn't live in Yuma. But then we'd be competing with the hospital because they do oncology studies. So our growth is limited in some respects. As far as new therapeutic areas, maybe we could add a couple more. But we have like no ceiling when it comes to getting studies for the therapeutic areas we already have, which I think is a good enough base for a sustainable business over the next several decades, really. The other issue becomes the PIs. Most of them are near retirement age. We do have younger doctors waiting in the wings, but they have no equity in anything. They've expressed interest that they would like to if the situation presented itself. So Chris and I have thought about everything for Yuma Clinical Trials with the intent of eventually selling it. Like that was the goal when we came here, was to eventually sell it, 5-year plan. So we tried to consider what an investor would think. You know, hey, does this business operate well without you? What happens if the PIs retire? Those kind of things. We try to have contingencies in place. Chris, I don't know if you want to add anything else.
So what not really to that situation, because I think you explained it well, Dan, but what specifically is your investment group looking for, Leland?
So I will just say that this is, one of a handful of areas in the healthcare world that we're exploring. So we are not beholden to make an investment in this space. We keep a little bit wider aperture in terms of what we look at. But if we were to look at seriously investing in a site or site network, I think that the easiest filtering criteria for us would be the size of the organization from a revenue and EBITDA perspective. It would be some basic motivations of the owner, whether they want to stay on,
Which
and you know what,
do you prefer in it? Which do you prefer in that scenario? Staying on or not?
so it if we if we have a good candidate that we feel is that we know from outside the business, that we feel is ready and willing to, in this case, move to Yuma, Arizona and take it over, then it's fine if the sellers are want to sell 100% and move on to whatever is left. In a lot of cases, though, going back to what I said at the beginning, we feel like we understand the space pretty well, but are nowhere near as capable as the people that have built it from scratch and run it day to day. So having there's a lot of value in having somebody who is willing to stay on after a transaction, and usually they maintain a minority ownership stake in the business, so there's some skin in the game, and then there's potential to sell that remaining stake in the future. So I wouldn't say that one or the other is a must-have criteria for us, but it's a really important factor. And depending on where we are with our team, and who we have in the stable ready to go and help us out, it could be a make or break. And apologies, I'm speaking in generalities here, and I think we could keep it that way for now. But, you know, those are some of the really important things for an investor to think about.
Sure. And the reason I'm asking the question is because your, you know, your LinkedIn profile and your website's going to be down there in the
right.
comments. So we don't want people reaching out that really aren't in the spectrum of what you're looking for. Right. So trying to get narrow it down a little bit for you.
I see. So, and this information is on our website as well. We look for businesses that are 5 million more in revenue, that are 1 to 10 million in EBITDA, that have a track record of growth. And I would add a little bit to that, that, again, because there's some variation in the number of trials, you know, that businesses like yours are able to conduct at any one time, and not a ton of visibility into the long-term future, I think that floor of EBITDA would be a bit higher for this space, 2-3 million of EBITDA. And I would also say that if it's a business where a huge chunk or a majority of their revenue is vaccine related, that would be you know, cause for concern for us.
There you go, guys. We haven't done vaccine studies, so that's it's good revenue, but it sounds like if you want to sell your site, you might be wasting your time.
Well, yeah, it depends what you want to do. And you know, it could be a great cash flow machine, but if it doesn't have if we don't see a path to sustainability for several years, then it's not the right investment for us. And that's not to say that other investors wouldn't see differently.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. Another factor that is important to us, that you mentioned a little bit, Dan, is geography. So, you know, we're totally open, in the US, but, you know, we would be taking a very close look at the labor dynamics in whichever area, the demographics of the patients, the potential patients that live in that whatever catchment area of the site or sites, the proximity to other competitors or other sites that operated, you know, similar types of trials. And a good one that you added, Dan, is the kind of referral dynamics with providers, hospitals, academic medical centers, et cetera, that may be in the area. All these things, you know, combine to potentially make or break an investment case, but it's really hard to kind of provide cutoffs about what is not acceptable. You kind of have to look at everything holistically and come to a conclusion there.
What about diversity? It's one of the things, I think it was Chris or Brad, somebody keeps mentioning, and I definitely think that's going to happen as well. By 26 or 2027, the FDA is going to start to demand diversity numbers in their clinical study reports that they review. And all it's going to take, I mean, if everyone thinks like this is a big topic now, wait till the FDA does not approve a drug specifically because of their diversity numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if that trickles down to sites, I do think that sites located in diverse areas and underserved areas, I'm heavily pitching for Yuma clinical trials right now, should demand a higher return on their acquisition. What do you think about that? Not all sites are built the same.
Right. You know, certain patient demographic profiles are persistently underrepresented in clinical trials. And I think as long as that is the case, those sites that are able to enroll high percentage of those types of patients will be a little bit more valuable. You know, all things equal, it just makes sense. You know, hopefully, you know, we get to a place where it's not a huge concern, and it's pretty easy to you know, get a patient sample that's representative of the overall population. But it hasn't been that way for a while, and you know, I would be surprised if it flips to be that way in the near future. So yeah, certainly really important point of investigation for investors and something that could change the value of the business.
Well, this is a great podcast, hopefully, for site owners in this situation. There are site networks out there looking to acquire as well. And there are hospital systems. We have one in our town that indirectly expressed interest. I know if I were to pursue it, we would have conversations, at least exploratory ones, because they're known for buying everything in town that does well for them, and they do research, so it's a natural fit. You guys might be experiencing competition as well as far as going after sites. How long do you think this frenzy lasts? Do you think it has an end in sight, or do you think this is like the new norm for the next decade?
I think it's a complicated story. I think in the next year or so, it's going to cool off a little bit. There was a frenzy in, frankly, almost every area of private equity investment in immediately following COVID. And there's a bunch of macroeconomic reasons why that has slowed down and is going to stay slower than it has been with respect to the kind of clinical research world broadly. All of the COVID trials are a bit of an anomaly, you know, knock on wood. And I think that some of the larger site networks out there that are maybe a little bit overexposed to vaccine trials are going to struggle a little bit. And, you know, in the case of private equity investment in those firms, you know, they typically have a debt burden. And if they're not generating the revenue that they thought they were going to be, that debt payment becomes a problem. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see some issues there with some of the existing private equity backed players. But I think going back to that longer term trend I talked about, I don't think that's going away. The innovation, you know, from a 5-year or 10-year perspective, is on a good trajectory, and the spending that goes behind that as well. And even though people think that, you know, at some point we're going to completely, you know, use synthetic data and we won't need humans to conduct clinical trials, I think that is not going to happen anytime soon. And so there will be a continuous need, and in fact, a greater need for sites to conduct the day-to-day clinical trial work. So bit of a complicated story. I think we're bullish on the space, obviously. And then the other thing I would say with respect to competition is that there are different types of investors that make sense for different individuals. You know, as you mentioned, there are site networks out there that are acquiring new businesses, and in many cases that might be a good option for a small business leader, and they can either, you know, join a large organization, walk away, you know, with some cash, and there's a lot of infrastructure and support in those businesses that could be helpful. There are other entrepreneurs or business owners that, you know, would rather not be part of a large machine and want to continue to build their own brand and you know, leverage the financial and strategic support that you know, somebody like us or other investors can offer. And I'll point to one example that in a different healthcare space from our past. So we invested in a oral surgery practice in New Jersey 2 years ago, and this practice had been approached by other larger oral surgery platforms. The business leaders preferred to chart their own course and grow their own organization. That made sense for us, and you know, we've grown that you know, from a few sites in New Jersey to far larger number of sites across the Northeast. And so it depends, going back to what I said earlier about the motivations of the business owner, and that can help them figure out what type of investor makes sense for them, whether it's an independent, you know, private equity company that doesn't yet have a site network, or an existing site network, or some other type of seller or buyer.
So I don't know how much you can dive down into the specifics of that, but I'm curious, in that situation you just described in New Jersey with the oral surgeon, what did the percentage of ownership look like? Did I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they still retained a fairly large percentage of ownership to want to expand like that, right? Because if there's minority stakeholders of 5%, say, they may have less interest in, because that's a lot of work to expand, right? So can you state what the percentage of ownership they retained was? I'm curious.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give specifics for that one, but I think that 20 to 30% is a pretty typical benchmark for the percent that would be retained by the sellers in a transaction. And obviously there are exceptions on the high and low end of that, but I think it's about giving them enough where they have skin in the game and are going to be as motivated as they have been to continue to operate and grow their business. But in the same time, enough so that the investor is motivated to put all that cash up front, and you know, retain, you know, a majority stake in the business. So 20 to 30 is a good benchmark.
Okay. Yeah, that seems reasonable. Can I ask you a few more questions? Because as Dan mentioned, we have a site network, and oftentimes I'm fielding questions about, you know, selling their site, and I have no idea what the answers are. So, and you know, you can't speak in terms of all other investors, but what would a typical deal look like, right? I mean, you're looking for the owners to stay on for, like you said, sometimes indefinitely, sometimes at least for a year or two, I would imagine. Even in 100% acquisition, you're looking for them to stay on for a little while to transition everything over, right? What does the EBITDA look like? What, I mean, in your specific investor group, what is their just general deal? And I understand this isn't strict, right? It could depend on a number of factors on maybe it's more or less, but just generally speaking, do you have any generalities you can share?
Sure. Maybe I can give you a kind of hypothetical transaction.
Sure.
You know, if you have a $5 million EBITDA business and you're going to buy it for 10 times EBITDA, $50 million, and you want the owner to stay on for the next hold period, which would be several years ideally, but in a contract there might be language that incentivizes them to stay on for 1 or 2 or 3 years, and they roll 20% stake in the business. So 20% of 50 would be 10 million. And so, you know, you write, and they own 100% prior to the transaction, you write them a check for $40 million. They still own 20% of the business. And the money, you know, from the investor side would be, you know, a mix of our own equity and some debt. You know, we tend to be on the conservative side when it comes to debt, especially if we're trying to grow the business quickly. We want to have enough cash to be able to invest in new talent. You know, if it's a brick and mortar business, new square footage, et cetera. But you might have, you know, 10, 15 million at the high end, $20 million of debt on the business, hopefully at a low interest rate. So it's not a huge burden to the P&L. And, you know, some of the things that we would be looking to do early on with a business are support the leader with other, you know, C-suite type team members as needed. In many cases, there's existing folks that are really great and they stay on. You know, sometimes they need a CFO. If part of the business strategy is to be very acquisitive, then you might bring on somebody who's done a lot of M&A onto the team as well. It's going to be introductions to you know, folks in the space that we know quite well, that could either be referral sources, technology vendors, you know, just other experts that know the space really well, that can trade notes with the team, set up a kind of more regular cadence when it comes to financial reporting and, you know, all of the kind of process infrastructure that goes into it. And different investors do that to more or less degree. You know, on the extreme side, you might have some that are doing weekly calls and financial reporting. On the other side, it might be quarterly. You know, I think we tend to be have a little bit more faith in the business leaders in setting their own cadence and their own vision for the organization. But again, it varies from investment to investment. So I could go on, but hopefully that's helpful in giving you a gist of how a transaction might look. And I'm happy to go into more detail where I can.
Yeah, that's great. so, but generally speaking, I wouldn't imagine most of your deals are 10 EBITDA. Or is that approximately what they generally are?
And 10 times EBITDA. I mean, it depends. Yeah, it depends. I think, you know, if it's, if you have a 70% margin business, it, you know, people pay up for that stuff. And,
yes.
It, you know, obviously there's a premium as you reach a scale. You know, we talked about diversification of revenue, and just limiting the downside risk as the business grows. You know, the multiple can grow often too. But you know, everything we talked about could move the needle on the valuation of the business, the faith in the existing management team, whether they have already invested in personnel that are ready to take the business to the next level, or whether external folks are going to be needed to be brought on, you know, what the local demographics and labor market look like, you know, what type of contracts they have with their investigators, what the repeat business is with the CROs or sponsor customers, how volatile revenue has been historically. I mean, any number of things can move the needle. You know, 10, I use it's an even number, right? It's a
sure. Easy to do the math.
Yeah. I think there's some public information out there about some of the larger sites are, you know, have traded for in the past. And sure. So those are more than 10 times. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, I think, I mean, maybe I'm stupid. Maybe I'm stupid. That's why I'm not an investor. But I think the smaller sites, I actually wrote an article on this like in 2016. Above 10 million, like growth is limited, I think, EBITDA. Between 1 to 10 is like the sweet spot for an investor. And then anything under 1, lower EBITDA as well. That was my thought process back in 2016. Has that changed? Or is that like...
That's broadly correct. If you're talking about like a single site or a small network of sites, you know, when I'm referring to public information, some of the larger site networks that were sold from one private equity investor to another private equity investor, you know, we're talking, you know, many times larger,
hundreds of millions of dollars.
There's a premium that comes with that size, but no, I think the windows you mentioned are broadly correct, And when I say there's wiggle room in terms of what can move up or down valuation, it might be one turn of EBITDA or 1.5 turns of EBITDA or half a turn of EBITDA, right? It's not moving from
right.
10 to 20.
Or if you're a site like on the growth trajectory and you're only like 4 years in and you're just under that million EBITDA, it doesn't mean if everything else, you know, if everything else checks the box in a hot market like this, they'll make exceptions, right? These are just like broad strokes we're trying to paint with, just to give people a general overview. Because I know people watching or listening are going to say, well, I sold my site for, you know, X amount and it's only 500 K EBITDA. Well, that's true. I mean, it happens, but we're trying to paint a broad picture here. This has been a great pod. I think we need to do a part two.
Yeah, let me know. I'd be happy to. We've only kind of just scratched the surface on some of the kind of more nitty gritty topics. But it's been great.
Can I ask you something real quick, Chris? I don't know if you could let our 9 o'clock Zoom know we might be a little late. Like, Leland, maybe you don't even have the answer, but is it fair to say that whatever is going on in healthcare in general parallels research, actually is a leading indicator of what should happen in clinical research? So, for example, private practices getting acquired by large health systems. And now we're seeing private sites getting acquired by sometimes large health systems, sometimes site networks. Are these things correlated or in any meaningful way, do you think?
I think there is some correlation. I think the correlation is mostly from the investor perspective rather than the dynamics that are going on at a provider versus a site. The buy and build strategy has been employed by healthcare investors for a long time, you know, going back to dentist offices in the 90s. And you know, a lot of subsectors of healthcare are very fragmented and the opportunity exists to invest in them at scale. And you know, investors are competitors too. And if you're looking at the dental space right now, there's 50 private equity firms. I'm kind of, you know, roughly guessing there, but there's a lot of investor backed companies there, competing for the same set of dental practices, which is great if you're a dentist that's looking to sell. But from an investor perspective, you know, it might still be a good investment, but it's competitive. And so I think that it's natural that investors are looking to other areas, particularly if they're the sort that are focused on healthcare and turn their attention to pharma services broadly and sites as kind of one subsector there. So I think they are related. I mean, yeah, I think the macro trends that are affecting the level of bargaining power and money going into clinical research are kind of separate from what's going on in the provider world. But yeah, there's definitely a trend from the investor perspective.
If you follow the money, though, does it ultimately get back to the same people investing? Or is that too simplistic?
I think it's too simplistic. I think that there are definitely investors that are doing the same sort of thing in different subsectors of healthcare. And there are others that, you know, a dental services organization is their only healthcare investment and they do things in totally other industries. So to some degree, but it's investor by investor.
Thank you for that. Because thank you. I think the information you have is levels more sophisticated than our anecdotal experiences. But I had a feeling that this research as a care option is nonsense. And there's a lot of people pushing for that. But the only way that works is if all the health systems buy into it. And that means buying into research sites. This is the only way I see how it gets done. And It doesn't sound like that's actually going to happen. So, sounds like a pipe dream. Maybe oncology separate, but I'm talking about everything else, all other therapeutic areas. I don't think research as a care option has actual legs other than idealistically in the minds of certain people.
Right. Well, yeah, the healthcare world is huge, and people are trying to innovate all the time. But I think a good rule of thumb is to think about inertia in this space. What's in motion will stay in motion, and there are so many, large players in every part of the healthcare ecosystem, including the government, that have their own motivations, and it's really hard to move them.
Wow.
The examples you could point to where things have been tried and haven't worked. So yeah, on the margins, that might be the case, but I wouldn't expect any major changes soon.
Inertia and entropy. So inertia, an object in motion, will stay in motion until something stops it. And entropy, things will go to chaos unless energy is put into maintaining the
Right.
system.
Right, and that's the energy that you guys are putting in at Yuma and with this podcast and I'm sure countless others are doing with their own projects. So that's you're fighting a good fight against entropy.
Thank you. Yeah, it's funny how the laws of physics sometimes apply to business as well.
Right. Well, I know we're wrapping up on time here, so I'm open to continuing the conversation with both of you at a later date, and then obviously, anyone listening has my contact information. Happy to chat, but I really appreciate the time with you both and the ability to share my perspective and hear from you guys about your thoughts from the psych world.
Well, thank you for being on, Leland.
Thank you very much, Leyland, and thank you, Chris, for setting this up. This was a great
Certainly.
one. Appetite. This will be a classic. So, everyone that wants to connect with Leyland, his LinkedIn's underneath. I almost said your YouTube. You don't have a YouTube, right? Your
No, not.
LinkedIn's underneath, and the website, which we will get for you underneath this video or in the podcast episode. Definitely gonna do a part two at some point. Thank you so much for giving us a pulse of the industry as it relates to investments. And we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.